Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Dugout Debate. My name is Tim Husbury.
And I'm Chris Kerr.
This week, we talk scandals. We have dug through the hundreds of sporting scandals from across the ages and have compiled our list of our top 10 sporting scandals. We hope you enjoy. So, number one, rather unsurprisingly and fairly current, given they've just been accepted back into the Olympic fold, the Russian doping scandal in Sochi in 2014. Funnily enough, we have actually done a podcast on this already, so this would be a good time to plug it. If you haven't heard that, listen to that now, and that will give you all the information that you need regarding the doping scandal. But Chris, in a few sentences, what happened?
So doping in Russian sports has been a bit of some systemic nature, and they've had 41 Olympic medals stripped for doping violations over the years, which is the most for any country. And from 2011 to 2015, more than 1,000 Russian competitors in various sports, including summer, winter and Paralympic sports, benefited from a cover-up of their massive doping.
Yep, and most specifically in Sochi, where we heard from Gregory Rodchenkov, who let us know all about how they got away with doped up samples and moved them through the various buildings in the Russian anti-doping sector of Sochi and got the clean urine in the other end so they could fake negative test results. There's not much more to say about it, really. Scandal, definitely the most scandalous scandal of ever scandal in sports scandal. And yeah, that's why it sits at number one. But we'll leave that there for now. I think everyone can appreciate that that's why that's up there.
Definitely check out our other podcast on that.
100%. It's a good listen. And also, go and give Icarus a watch on Netflix.
Yeah.
So, number two on our list is the Italian match-rigging scandal back in 2006, more affectionately known by the Italian media and press, and I'm sure many Italians out there, as, cue terrible Italian, Calciopoli. Sounds like a pretty decent pizza to me.
Yep.
Which essentially implicated a number of high-profile teams in Serie A. That included Juve, most notably, AC Milan, Fiorentina and Lazio. So, essentially what happened? There were some telephone interceptions in 2006 related to another scandal that a team of investigators was investigating. And whilst doing this, the interceptions revealed there was quite comprehensive match rigging amongst Italy's major clubs and referee designators in Serie A. The actual allegation in the Calciopoli scandal relates to the Juve sporting director attempting to influence results by selecting referees that may favour Juventus. Put simply, a Juve sporting director rang up the referee designators for the week and said, hey, give us old whatever his name is, referee who kind of likes Juventus. So the marginal decisions would go their way and then they would win the titles that they want to win. Which is almost quite funny considering how dominant Juventus have been in the last few years.
Yeah, they didn't need to do it, did they?
Post this. No, yeah. Silly. But anyway, so back on the 4th of July 2006, the prosecutor involved with the scandal called for severe sanctions to be dealt to the main clubs. So like I said, Juventus, AC Milan, Fiorentina and Lazio. Initially, the ruling was all clubs were going to be demoted. But after all the appeals and outcome, Juventus were by far the worst hit. Juve were demoted to Serie B, having won the title in the 05-06 season and the season before in 04-05. So they were stripped of those wins and obviously deducted to last place in the previous season and then demoted to Serie B, where actually a number of the team members who were part of the 05-06 winning side decided to stick and they bounced back immediately, I think. AC Milan were deducted 8 points from the 06-07 season, so the season following the outcome of the scandal, and 30 points from the 05-06 season, so they didn't finish in any of the European places, didn't compete in Europe in the next season. Fiorentina were deducted 15 points from the 06-07 Serie A season, again, weren't allowed to compete in Europe, and Lazio were deducted 3 points from the 06-07 season and also weren't allowed to compete in Europe. This is quite so high up the list because, if anything, you want sport to be integral and officiated improperly. And this is quite a case in point where that is obviously not what was happening. I'm all for referees perhaps trying to placate to a fairly rowdy crowd, but placating to a man who's putting money in various pockets, probably not the best idea.
Yeah.
What do you think, Chris?
Well, I think it was amazing that it involved quite so many clubs and it went on for so many years as well, for that to to go on at such a high level. I mean, sometimes you'd think about it happening at a lower level of sport to get away with it, but obviously football's the main sport in Italy, so for it to have got past the authorities for as long as it did, it is outstanding.
I think it did have quite a damaging effect on Italian football,
yes,
as well.
Definitely.
I know back in the days of James Richardson and the Football Italia kind of stuff, just after the 94, just after Italia 90, there was a real hype about Italian football and the First League and all that sort of stuff. Juventus, Napoli, Milan, all those great teams that we all know and love.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it sort of comes all crashing down because of some all too greedy men who don't trust their own players to win the game, which is...
It is sad to see it in the state that it is today, because obviously they won the 2006 World Cup as well in that sort of time period. But a lot of it's due to the finances of Italian football as well, for them to be struggling as they are these days.
Because they were, for a good time, probably one of the richest leagues in the world. But, you know, perhaps all this negative press around the
Definitely.
Time when football was starting to get all the money really did give it a good punch in the gut. And
it clearly turned the fans off, because they've stopped attending the games in the droves that they were before.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll move swiftly on to number three. Chris, do you want to take us through this one?
Sure. The third one is the Ben Johnson scandal, when he was caught doping after winning the 100-metre final. So on September 24th, 1988, Johnson became the first sprinter from Canada since Percy Williams in 1928 to win the 100-metre final at the Summer Olympics in Seoul, and he lowered his own world record to 9.79 seconds. Johnson would later remark that he would have been even faster had he not raised his hand in the air just before he finished the race. However, 3 days later, Park Jong-sae of the Olympic Doping Control Centre found that Johnson's urine sample contained stanozol, and he was disqualified. He later admitted having used steroids when he ran in his 1987 world record, which caused the IAAF, unsurprisingly, to rescind that record. And Johnson and coach Francis complained that they used doping in order to remain on an equal footing with other top athletes on drugs, something that we heard about in our cycling pod to do with the sport of cycling in our doping podcast as well. In their testimony before inquiry in Dublin into the drug use, Francis charged that Johnson was only one of many cheaters and he just happened to get caught, so there were lots more out there. But yeah, for it to be on quite this bigger stage, obviously pretty much everyone in the Western world anyway watches the 100 metre final to find out who the fastest man in the world is currently, and for that to have involved a drugs cheat, I think, is a fairly big scandal and deserves to be third on our list.
Well, you say the 100 metre final involved a drugs cheat. If we look back through the last few 100 metre finals in the Olympics, how many of them have been convicted of drug cheats? So whilst that's not necessarily the point, it's when the guy who wins it proven drug cheat 3 days later. I think if you go back and say, oh, this guy cheated sort of 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 8 years ago, however long, in a world champs, you kind of go, eh. But this is literally 3 days after.
Yeah.
So, you know, the doping they were doing clearly wasn't very subtle, was it? You know,
they weren't. Yes, they if weren't it came using, up that quickly.
They weren't using the most high tech and undetectable doping techniques. They just gave him something, he won, and then he lost, basically, didn't he?
Oops.
The thing about that particular race, I think quite a few athletes said this at the time, is how when they were going, sort of the acceleration or the maintenance of his top end speed at the end of the race was what was so amazing. Because usually athletes hit their peak speed, 70, 80 metres in, but then they start slowing down because you can't maintain that kind of power that long. But he just kept going at that same speed, which was incredible. So,
it is interesting that that's what the drugs do. A lot of people that were uneducated maybe would have thought it just increased how fast they could go to start with, but it was his ability to, as you say, keep the speed at the end that made the difference.
Yeah. It's all about those pathways, molecular pathways, etc., etc., and just keeping that extra few seconds of performance, and that's what makes the difference. So pretty bad. Infamous and pretty bad. Right, so number four, pretty much everyone will know about this. Cantona and his flying kung fu kick back in January 1995. So it was in the midst of the Man United versus Blackburn season, just after the Premier League had probably kicked off. And Man United travel down to London to play Crystal Palace on the 25th of January 1995. Eric Cantonell, I think we can all agree, was the mercurial talent in that Man United side. An excellent player, sort of laissez-faire attitude while he's on the pitch, but also sort of a bit of a bite to him. And in this particular game, he didn't have the best of first halves, and in fact, he was actually very well shepherded by a Palace player, Richard Shaw. And early in the second half, Cantona had finally broken, having been riled by Richard Shaw, and he just went round and gave him a good old boot, a pretty vicious tackle, and was subsequently sent off by the referee, like I said. As he was walking off with Alex Ferguson with hands in pockets, Cantona took offence to an unknown comment from a Crystal Palace fan called Matthew Simmons, who was 20 at the time. And I don't know what the comment was. Presumably it was quite bad, or maybe he just said something about him being French, we don't know. And he decided that the best course of action at this moment in time was to launch himself into the now infamous kung fu kick aimed at the Palace fan. It's quite incredible pictures, isn't it? The girl in the sort of girl in the pink coat next to the Matthew Simmons guy, just sort of doing the scream kind of look. Simmons himself sort of doing the proper gurn that you probably would if you're having some 6'2" Frenchman flying through the air at you foot first and studs first. As a result of it, Cantona was banned for 9 months by the FA, just slapped with the ban immediately, so he didn't return to the next season. And after being sentenced to 2 weeks of prison time, it was reduced to just 120 hours of community service. It was quite a big one. I think that really sort of ended Cantona's career pretty much in the Premier League, and it sort of the first mercurial talent of the Premier League era flew out, if you're using the seagulls analogy, flew out and followed the trawlers. a pretty special move by somebody who's actually quite well loved by, I think, a lot of English people just for being a bit insane Frenchman.
I think that one's truly remarkable, because obviously there's so much said at footballers every single football game that they always keep their cool and don't react to anything that's said to them. So for someone to lose their head quite in the fashion that he did, it was pretty extraordinary, and everyone's going to remember it in English football pretty much forever.
I think if we're talking about Frenchmen reacting badly to comments from one particular person, we can also just slide this in at, we'll call it 4B. So 4A is Cantona's flying kick. We can put 4B, a good old Zinedine Zidane, the other French mercurial talent back in 2006, where he single-handedly cost France the World Cup with their headbutt with, was it Materazzi? Who scored the winning penalty, didn't he? Materazzi said something about Zidane's mum, and Zidane was like, nope, not having that, and just gave him a good old headbutt in the middle of the chest right in front of the referee. So obviously he left the field, and so did all the chances of France winning that particular World Cup.
That was his last ever game for France.
Yeah, and then he retired.
Well,
I think he retired totally after that, didn't he?
Retired, all told, I think.
Good way to go. We are absolutely smashing through these. We're already at number five. So, Chris, tell us about some Pakistani spot fixing.
Yes, so we were at number five is the Pakistan cricket spot fixing scandal, which was a scandal which centred on a certain members of the Pakistani national cricket team who were convicted of taking bribes from a bookmaker called Mazhar Majeed to deliberately underperform at certain times in a test match at Lord's in 2010. Undercover reporters from the News of the World secretly videotaped Mazhar Majeed accepting the money and informed the reporters that fast bowlers Asif and Amir would deliberately bowl no balls at certain points in an over. And this information could be used by gamblers to place bets with inside information. In response to these allegations, Scotland Yard arrested Majeed on a charge of match fixing, and the International Cricket Council, or ICC, banned three players, Salman Butt, Mohammed Asif and Mohammed Amir, for terms of between 5 and 10 years. In November 2011, Butt and Asif were found guilty by a London court on criminal charges relating to spot fixing. Amir and Majeed had entered guilty pleas on the same charges, and all four were given prison sentences ranging from 6 months to 32 months. So yes, a very serious scandal.
Well, I was actually watching that that test match at Lords, and it was kind of ridiculous, wasn't it, how far they were.
It was obvious, wasn't it?
So yeah. For anyone, again, who hasn't really seen any cricket, when you're bowling, you have to essentially bowl behind a white line. So you can't just run straight up to the batsman and lob it at the stumps, because that's just, you know, what's the point then? So you have to bowl it from a certain point, which is called the crease, and you have to have a part of your foot behind that line when you bowl the ball. Usually, you know, bowlers are very good at getting sort of the same run up and getting right to the edge of the crease. So they're really playing with the very fringes of what's possible with getting your foot down behind the line. But in this particular game, when there was no ball, it was by a good couple of foot, almost a meter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was not even close. It was just like they.
It didn't look like it was an accident at all, which obviously it wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to do it, at least make an effort to make it look accidental. Why didn't they just? What I don't get is, yes, I get betting can be specific. You can book on bet on throw-ins in a particular minute and that sort of thing. But what I don't know is if you can bet if there's going to be a no ball via stepping over the popping crease or chucking it over the batsman's head when you're bowling. Because that's an easier mistake to make.
Yeah, I don't know if it was that specific.
I doubt it would be that specific. So I would personally, if I was going to do it, that's what I'd do. If you're listening, Paddy Power, that's how I'll do it. You know, not that I'm saying Paddy Power do any of that sort of stuff. I just picked them because that's the first betting company I could think of. Yeah, well, I wouldn't have made it that obvious, and you know, they got duly punished. I think actually they've actually returned from their bans now, haven't they? It's been that long. God.
Yeah.
I'm only 23, but I already feel old.
Do you think it would have been found out if it hadn't had the News of the World sting operation in there as well? Because we've said it was really obvious. And do you think the ICC would have looked it into themselves that those incidents were so fishy?
They probably would have done. I think that the sort of nail in the coffin would be if they changed their run-up to do it, which they probably wouldn't have done. You know, these guys practice with the same run-up for years, basically, don't they? And they adjust it and they take lots of time to do all that adjustment. And there's no way you're getting that far out just on any given day with your run-up, especially just sort of randomly. You might do it a few
by the margins they were. You're gonna miss by the back of your foot a tiny bit, but not by a whole foot, which it wasn't.
But everyone's had sort of a rubbish over where they've just missed a bit, so you just bring it back or forward, but you don't do it like by that distance randomly. So yeah, they got what they deserved. Anyway, from the world of cricket to a rather colder world of ice skating. Chris, I think this ties in with a movie that's coming out very soon.
Number 6 was very apt, having just had the Winter Olympics, and obviously I, Tonya, I believe, is up for several awards in this awards season, BAFTAs and Oscars, etc. The Tonya Harding scandal at the 1994 Olympics. So on January the 6th, 1994, Harding's main team competitor on the US figure skating team, Nancy Kerrigan, was attacked after a practice session in Detroit by an assailant, later identified as Shane Stant. Harding's ex-husband Jeff Gillooly, very good name, and her self-appointed bodyguard Sean Eckhart hired Stant to break Kerrigan's right leg so that she would be unable to compete in the 1994 Winter Olympics in Lillehammer. After failing to find Kerrigan at her training rink in Massachusetts, Stant followed her to Detroit, and when she stepped off the ice after a practice session at Cobra Arena and walked behind a nearby curtain into a corridor, Stant struck her leg about 1 inch above the knee with a 21-inch telescopic batten. Her leg was only bruised, not broken, but the injury forced her to withdraw from the National Skating Championships, which Harding won later. And she and Kerrigan were both selected for the 1994 Olympic team, as Kerrigan seemed to make what was a miraculous recovery. Harding finished 8th at Lillehammer, while Kerrigan, by then recovered from her injury, as we said, won the silver medal behind Oksana Bayul from Ukraine. So an incredible comeback from tragedy for her. But yeah, I think the more interesting line to take is looking at Tonya Harding herself and why she felt that was needed to even have a level playing field going into that. And obviously so interesting that they've made a Hollywood film about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're going to do that, at least be the third best in the world rather than eighth. You know, yes. Like it wasn't even that close. If you're going to do it to everyone.
Yeah, take out all of your competition and then you are going to win gold. Yeah,
everyone's met with a very mysterious accident weeks before the Olympics.
It sounds like they didn't have enough imagination to do that to that many people, because a baton smashing someone on a leg behind a curtain after training, I mean, did they really think they're going to get away with that?
Yes. I mean, it's not like you could plant black ice on an ice rink. That's quite difficult. Maybe
that is.
Maybe sort of pop some water outside of the ice rink when they're sort of like just, you know how difficult it is just to walk on ice skates. Maybe that would have been a more sensible solution and probably would have led
to... Or you could have gone Blades of Glory style and chucked some pearls or something onto the ice so that they break their ankle while skating.
Brutal.
Yeah. Only in a film that would ever happen.
In a film. So from one kind of Olympics to a very different kind, summer and Paralympic this time. We're going all the way back to Sydney Paralympics, where we are talking about the Spanish basketball team. So shortly after the Spanish Paralympic basketball team won their gold medal, Carlos Ribagorda, a member of the victorious team, and an undercover journalist revealed to the Spanish business magazine Capital that most of his colleagues had not, in fact, undergone medical tests to ensure that they had disability. The International Paralympic Committee investigated the claims and found that the required mental tests had not been performed on several of the athletes, which should show that their competitors have an IQ of no more than 75. Ribagorda, the victorious Spaniard, alleged that some of the Spanish participants in other disciplines, such as table tennis, track and field, and swimming, were also not disabled, meaning that 5 medals had been won fraudulently. That's a bit cheeky, I think, isn't it?
Definitely. I don't know how do they think they'd get away with that without any sort of testing?
I don't know.
Because surely anyone that goes to the Paralympics has to be tested in some sort of way to see whether they're able to go.
Do you call that intellectual doping?
Yes, that's a good way of putting it, yeah.
Of all the things we've spoken about, this feels the most horrible.
Well, it's taken it away from people that would love that opportunity just to showcase himself on that stage. So to even think about doing them out of that chance is horrible.
It feels almost like a sort of systemic kind of thing. So it's like, oh, screw you guys. You're not sort of good enough to make this team anyway, because we've got fully able people, without wanting to be offensive, who are going to take your place to make sure that we win a gold. And I know the Spanish love their basketball and they're usually a very good team in the Olympics and that sort of thing. But come on.
Yeah.
You know, that's not what the Paralympics are about. It's about sport for everyone and, you know, overcoming adversity and that sort of thing. And there's no adversity in having a competitive advantage over all your fellow competitors by not actually meeting the qualifying criteria in the first place.
Well, as you said, it's just completely against all of the things that the Olympics and Paralympics stand for. So
yeah. Of all the things we've spoken about, you know, doping, all that sort of thing, this feels the most grubby, the most sort of just backhanded.
Yes, because all of the others, they're trying to win at any cost, but that's the kind of environment that those sports are in, aren't they? That's you're gonna try and win anything you can do, and it turns out that these people have gone further than outside of the parameters that are legal. But in this case, the Paralympics isn't about that.
It shows one of the big problems with the Paralympics, where classifying athletes according to mental disabilities and indeed physical ones is notoriously quite difficult, because
it's
see athletes who have moved up or down a category in severity, either with progression of a disease, or maybe they've enhanced their training to mean that they're not quite so severely influenced or affected by their condition. You know, where is this becoming, where do you gain a competitive advantage by moving down or like into a more severe category? Who governs that sort of decision? Where does that where's the line crossed? There's obviously an element of subjectivity, as there would be in this kind of medicine. Like it opens up a big can of questions, and it would be remiss of me to say that I don't think this is not just a Spanish thing. I'm sure this has been done by other teams as well, seeking to gain a competitive advantage in a sport that's meant to be about inclusivity and that sort of thing. So this sits,
as you say, there's always been a question about the equipment that people are using, etc., with these blades that people are running on, etc. So there's always these question marks over how legitimate people winning these medals are.
Sorry, this is just to go a slightly different direction, but I suppose it's meant to get discussion going, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where do you draw the line with equipment and that sort of thing? Because in Formula One, for instance, you make the car as good as you can make it within the rules. So you push the boundaries of the rules to make the best machine that you can possibly make. I assume that would be the same in bobsled and all that kind of thing. Yes. Like, you're competing for a team in Formula One, you're competing for your country in the Paralympics, in the Olympics.
Yeah.
So in the Winter Olympics, in the bobsled, you get the best T-tray, you get the best sort of toboggan thing, whatever you want to call it.
You get the best runners on the,
Yeah, you get the best runners, the best aerodynamics and that sort of thing. So surely if you're able to develop the best blades, then surely you should be able to use them.
Yeah.
I don't think that, you know, we're quite at the stage where they're going to be blitzing world records.
That's because, what,
you know, you get problems with acceleration off the line.
Yeah.
But, you know, with the Oscar Pistorius before, or allegedly when he murdered his wife, he was quite close to being able to compete.
I even watched him at Olympics. So that was the big question mark, wasn't it, over the blades, whether it gave them an advantage with over able-bodied people just because of the spring in there. As you say, it gave them advantage at the start of the race, but I think that's, as you say, they were never actually going to be able to fully compete anyways, so if it gave them the tiny leg up that it did for them able to compete in a proper Olympics, I think it was worth doing in that case.
Yeah, but I think the Pistorius thing kind of blurs the lines of what I'm trying to say, really. It's just, you know, you try to get a competitive advantage by building the best possible vehicle or blades or whatever you have to get an advantage. Yeah. So, you know, whilst that would potentially just favour the more wealthy nations, then you also get the better athletes from the less wealthy nations. So it's sort of, there is an element of level playing field with that as well.
I guess that's why the Paralympics is much more complicated than the Olympics in the first place.
Yes, 100%. Anyway, that was plenty of time talking about that.
Very good.
Chris, we're going to go for this next one into the sport you love so much, into rugby and into Bloodgate. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I am sad that rugby actually makes this list. When I was trying to think of ones that came up, I was thinking, well, rugby's not had a scandal really, has it? And then this one popped straight into the head and I thought, damn, we are actually going to have to cover rugby on a sports scandals list. So yes, at number 8, it's the Bloodgate scandal involving English team Harlequins in the then Heineken Cup. In their match against Irish side Leinster on the 12th of April 2009. It was called the Bloodgate scandal because of a use of fake blood capsules and has been seen by some as one of the biggest scandals in rugby since it became professional in the mid-1990s. So to give you a bit more detail about the actual incident, during the quarterfinal of the 2009 Heineken Cup against Leinster, Harlequins winger Tom Williams came off the field with what turned out to be a faked blood injury in order to facilitate a tactical substitution for Nick Evans to re-enter the field, having gone off earlier injured. So to give you a bit more background on that for rugby, if someone gets injured with blood, it's counted outside of your substitution, so therefore they could have brought someone on that's already gone off again earlier. And in this situation, it really helped them to get Nick Evans back on the pitch because they needed a kick to be taken. So they cheated their way of getting Nick Evans on the pitch, if you like. And an investigation by the ERC and the RFU revealed that blood injuries had also been faked by Harlequins to enable tactical substitutions on 4 previous occasions. So it wasn't just one big incident, even though that was the one that they ended up getting caught for. These findings result in a 12-month ban for Williams, reduced to 4 months on appeal, and a 3-year ban for former director of rugby Dean Richards, and a 2-year ban for physiotherapist Steph Brennan, as well as a...
So, sorry, I'm just jumping in. There was a ban for the player who was taken off?
Yes, yeah.
What?
For popping the blood capsule in his mouth. They thought that he colluded and went along with it all. Obviously, the larger bands went for the people that were kind of at the top that went along with it and kind of organised it all. And the club also got a £260,000 fine, and club chairman Charles Gilling subsequently tendered his resignation, while club doctor Wendy Chapman was suspended by the GMC pending a disciplinary panel hearing into a cutting of Williams' lip to hide his use of the blood capsule, which is dastardly. And on the 2nd of September 2009, it was reported that Harlequins had escaped being thrown out of the Heineken Cup altogether following the scandal, when the board of organisers, the ERC or the European Rugby Cup, said it approved of the bans and fines already handed out and felt that was enough punishment for them. It didn't really help. It didn't really help them in the end, because Leinster ended up winning the game 6-5 and went on to win in the Heineken Cup themselves for the first time that year. So it didn't actually help Harlequins in the long run. Yeah.
6-5. Oh,
yeah, absolute classic.
I can see why they were making the substitution. It was obviously a bit rubbishy game, but
yeah, and they needed someone on to come in and kick it. Yeah.
Oh, that's not good. That just the way that so many people had to be involved and know what they were doing, and just
it's very messy, isn't it? And as you say, a lot of people are involved, which some of these have
that's
been
not
one
isolated
person.
Either.
Yeah, and four previous incidents.
Sorry. Even going back to more recently in the Six Nations with some rather questionable HIAs, head injury assessments.
That is what
the
I
French
thought.
Team.
Yeah.
You know, I think that sits under the same sort of lines, and you know how big a fan I am of doing an HIA, making sure the player is safe and that sort of thing. The very first one I saw, I was like, yeah, but watch the replay. That was his knee, not his head. Like, his head was never involved. And whilst, yes, you don't need, as I've said before, Concussion Podcast, first ever one, go give it a listen, really good. as I've said on that podcast, you don't necessarily need a full-on frontal impact to get a concussion. It can be the rotational forces on the way down. You know, that there was nothing in that tackle other than a sore knee, essentially. No. And,
well, the fact that he limped off the pitch said it all.
Yeah,
definitely exactly. Wasn't his head, he was limping.
Yeah. So they got an unfair advantage by being able to go and treat the player for 10 minutes.
Yes. They'd have been down to 14 men, wouldn't they? Because they'd used all their substitutions. So by doing that, they could stay at 15.
Exactly. And none of this is nice. Using medicine.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, player welfare is such a big thing in rugby and American football at the minute, and to be using that medical profession as a way of cheating your way through getting more substitutions, it's a really bad form.
I mean, we've had sort of a not a spate. That's not really the right word, but the medical profession, particularly in sport, recently has taken some quite big knocks with the scandal with the Team America gymnast doctor who was sentenced to like 200 years or something in prison in the US, and the doctors are meant to have sort of, whilst I don't believe they actually take the proper Hippocratic oath and put their hand on the stethoscope and go, I solemnly swear to do any good in medicine, you know, you'd like to think that the majority of doctors wanted to get into the profession in the first place to be able to help people and make sure that they're all above board, and there's so much sort of checking that has to go on in all of medicine.
Exactly.
The fact that these doctors decide to go rogue and do this just to get a few extra quid in their pocket and help their team succeed is totally not the point. You're there to facilitate your team succeeding. You're there to facilitate player welfare. You're not there to actively try and help them win, which is why I do agree with the bans slapped on them. But I don't think that, personally, I think that that was quite lenient.
On the doctors themselves?
On the whole club.
On the whole club. By banning them from further competition.
Yeah, for a following year.
Yeah.
I mean, it's straight up plain as day cheating.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't just once, it was a few times.
Yeah.
As was previously found. So,
The individuals to be punished, but then not the club themselves when it's been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This feels very sort of scapegoaty.
Yeah.
Let's pick on the people who we can replace because, you know, as good as any doctor is, you can replace them. You can't get back the winnings from TV rights and from competition success without the players and without the club competing in the highest level. So, you know,
it did feel like that for Dean Richards as well, because I'm not sure how much, obviously it's under his control being director of rugby, but for him to be the one that got the largest ban of 3 years, I think he was definitely the scapegoat in the face of it all, kind of thing.
Yeah, he was. But again, you know, these things will always have a scapegoat, but then the punishments have to be dished out to everyone involved. And I feel like the people that actually benefited from it sort of were led away with, not murder, but, you know, they were led away with it somewhat. I know £250,000 is a lot in rugby terms, particularly back in 2009.
Yeah.
But still.
Yeah.
Not good.
Credit to Dean Richards for bouncing back, to be fair. So he's been really good at Newcastle since it didn't kind of end his career, and they took a punt on him when they were down in the Championship, but he's definitely bounced back and made them a really good club. So that he's kind of not made that the defining part of his career, even though Tom Williams, sadly, is always going to be known as the Bloodgate player.
Any players going off with some rather suspicious looking arms, like sort of hanging off in a weird fashion? Maybe they've got their real arm just under their sleeve and another fake one just flopping out, sort of Harry Potter, Prisoner of Azkaban style. Anyway, on to number 9, and we're going quite a long way back. pretty much a whole century for this one. Chris, enlighten us.
Yes, so we've gone back to the World Series in 1919, which has been dubbed the Black Sox scandal, where the Major League Baseball match-fixing incident in which eight members of the Chicago White Sox team were accused of intentionally losing the 1919 World Series against the Cincinnati Reds in exchange for money from a gambling syndicate led by Arnold Rothstein. The fallout from the scandal resulted in the appointment of Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis as the first commissioner of baseball, granting him absolute control over the sport in order to restore its integrity. Despite acquittals in the public trial in 1921, Judge Landis permanently banned all eight men from professional baseball, so they never played baseball again, and the punishment was eventually defined to also include banishment from post-career honours, such as consideration for the Baseball Hall of Fame. And despite requests for reinstatement in the decades that followed, particularly in the case of shoeless Joe Jackson, the ban remains in force as of 2018. So, yeah, it was an absolutely massive deal, and I'm trying to remember the name of the film. I think it's Fields of Dreams with Kevin Costner that features the players that were banned in it.
Well, it's pretty safe to say I knew literally none of that before I heard Chris just say it then. That's really quite fascinating. Imagine that today. I know that, you know, sport is much more global than it was back then. Sort of some of the performances you see in some matches, I'm not talking about the Arsenal-Man City League Cup final, but I am, you know, where Gary Neville is talking about disgrace, disgrace, disgrace.
Yeah.
You know, if the players decide to sit back and not do a lot for their own gains, could still happen now. We've seen players deliberately try to get yellow cards to be banned for certain matches. How do we know that they're not gaining monetarily from those sort of actions? So, you know, it's something that somewhat foreboding for sport generally, and I think that there have probably been quite a few cases similar to this that have gone undetected.
Yeah, one that sprang to mind for me recently, being a St Helens and Rugby League fan, in 2004 there was a similar scandal but on a much smaller scale, where two players, Sean Long and Martin Gleeson, both players for St Helens at the time, bet on St Helens losing to Bradford Bulls on Easter Monday in 2004, because they knew that their side were going to play a weakened team in that game because they were scheduled to face Huddersfield Giants in a Challenge Cup semi-final the weekend after, and they both got heavy fines and were banned for 3 months and 4 months respectively. So yeah, it goes on in all sorts of different sports.
God, this is all making me sad. We keep doing these ones. We just keep getting upset with the state of sport. Let's just finish it off. Chris, give us number 10.
Cool. So sticking with rugby league, having just mentioned it, number 10 is the Melbourne Storm salary cap breach. For those that don't know what this was in the National Rugby League down in Australia, where they strictly enforce a salary cap on the league. So all the clubs have to spend a limited amount on their playing squad. And over a five-year period, it was discovered that the Melbourne Storm were well over that salary cap, and discovery of these breaches in 2010 by the NRL resulted in stripping the Melbourne Storm of all honours received as a team since 2006, which included 2007, 2009 and 2006 Premiership titles, and 2007 and 2008 League Leaders or Minor Premiership titles, where they finished top of the league but didn't go on to win the grand final. And also the 2010 World Club Challenge title was revoked more than 1 year since the initial penalties were first announced. And it actually led to most of their squad at the time being broken up, unsurprisingly, because they were over the cap by so much that it took them quite some time to get back under it. And I think because it was over such a long period, I think that's why it deserved to get onto our list, and it was by quite a lot of money and not just a little bit.
I'm sort of stunned that it took so long to find this out.
Yeah.
You know, I get that football clubs over here are often, you know, they're forced to show their books after a year or so, and you know, you get all the creative accounting, please, yeah, go back to our Neymar and Fair Play podcast. You notice that we're trying to plug all of them again, but you know, they have to publish their books yearly, so
yeah,
how on earth so, they got away with this for 5 years?
Yeah, going on the rugby union, obviously, knowing that better, that you get auditors in, as you say, every single year that have a look at your books to be able to see what was going on, so that it's difficult to hide that. But in this case, it was following claims by a whistleblower that the club were keeping a second set of books. The NRL conducted an investigation in late 2009 and early 2010. After initially denying the claims, the Storm officials confessed on the 22nd of April 2010 that the club had committed serious and systematic breaches of the salary cap for the last 5 years by running a well-organised dual contract and bookkeeping system, which left the NRL ignorant of $3.78 million in payments made to players outside of the salary cap.
I respect the effort. That seems like they've really done right. Let's do this properly.
Yeah, let's go big.
Fair enough. It's not just making, you know, fudging people into the Paralympics. That's going hard and going right. You can have this contract, but you're also going to get this one.
Yeah,
to us so we can win. I respect it. Not good. I don't condone it, kids. But I respect it. But yeah, it's financial doping, isn't it?
It is. Yeah,
and we've got two teams who currently play in European football who I would call financially doping: Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain, and they're backed by states, essentially. Why is that not financial doping? You know, financial fair play is meant to attenuate these issues of massive gaps between teams and try and level out the playing field. But, you know, they're getting money from a source which most teams don't have access to. And when you've got the power of an entire state behind you and you can buy a Brazilian 26-year-old for 200-odd million and then a French 19-year-old or 17, 18-year-old for in excess of 200 million.
Yeah.
Where's the fair play in that?
But, I was going to say it might be quite difficult for some football fans to understand the kind of salary cap breaches in another sport, because the money's just at a whole other level in football, isn't it? Where there seems to be very little control on it all. But in these kind of other sports, particularly rugby league and rugby union, the salary cap is so important, and the NFL even, to making sure that we get a bigger rotation of teams winning stuff. It's not always the same couple every time.
No, I do enjoy it, but I like both ways. I'm a bit of a hypocrite. I do like both ends of the spectrum. I really like the glitz and the glamour of the upper echelons of football, but I also like the fact that anyone can win the NFL, like the good old Eagles this year.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a great watch. It's the first time I've stayed up on my own to watch it. That I probably won't be doing that again on my own. But it was good.
Hopefully
was
I'll be there for you next time, Timmy.
Oh, hopefully, mate. Hopefully. anyway, that brings us right to the end of our big scandals in sport podcast. If you think that we've missed any off, please let us know. We deliberately left off a few just because we didn't think they were quite as exciting as the ones that are on this list. But please just let us know. We are at @dugout_debates across all of social media. And don't forget to check out our website, www.dugoutdebatepodcast.com.
Perfect. Thank you very much for listening, guys. Catch you next time.